Well, hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. Today, I go back to the Planet in Focus Film Festival. If you recall, last year I had the opportunity to speak with the wonderful Roberta Bondar, Canada's First Lady in Space, who was being honored with an award at the film festival. Today, the guest in regards to that festival is a young filmmaker and activist by the name of Slater Jewel Kemker, who has spent the last 10 years or so working on a documentary entitled Youth Unstoppable, which she started shooting as a teenager in 2008. And although the conversation is primarily on climate change and youth activism, we also touch into other aspects of it, like, you know, why this issue has become sort of the big cause for millennials. How much does food and agriculture play into it? And also the fact, because Slater is a dual citizen of Canada and the U.S., we talk about how she thinks both governments have been doing from a policy perspective of fighting climate change. After that, you'll also hear an interview with a great up and coming young actor, Luca Velasquez, who is in a very, very good new thriller film called Knuckleball, which stars him, Monroe Chambers from Degrassi, and Canadian legend Michael Ironside. So we talk about that and what it was like shooting in a forest in winter in Canada, because that seems to work for not only Canadian films, but Canadian thriller films as well. But first, here is my chat with filmmaker and activist Slater Jewel Kemker. I'm here with Slater Jewel Kemker. Kemker, hello, welcome.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Great to be here.
I fudged that name again. I'm sorry. That's Slater Jewel Kemker. There we go. I got it.
Just say it forcefully, and then it's all good.
Yeah, right. It's not a name you can, like, you know, you gotta eat syllable, as they would say.
Yeah.
You are here as part of the Planet in Focus Film Festival, and they are showing your film Youth Unstoppable, and I know you've been working on this for over a decade. I know you started filming it when you were in your teens, and that seemed to be quite a popular thing. A lot of teenagers that end up wanting to make a documentary, it tends to be about the environment or animal rights, something along those lines. What is it about our generation that is that subject matter is sort of our it's that's our big that's our big, you know, life thing?
Well, so I started making the film in 2008, which was pretty much a year after An Inconvenient Truth came out. And I think in that period of time, we were starting to see a lot of documentaries come out, whether it was on climate change, then global warming, or various environmental issues, or you know, really the list is endless. And I think because of having all of that media thrown at us, and particularly issues told through the lens of, I would say, more of a fear-based perspective, being that young, you look at the rest of your life and it's just, there is a moment of complete panic, or at least that's what I felt. I remember having seen that movie, and then for 2 days I just was almost inconsolable. I didn't know what to do with myself, because you're being told really that, oh, here's something that maybe you can't control, and everything you thought was going to be the trajectory of your life is now affected by that, and you might not be able to do anything about it. And I think maybe that's why you're starting to see a lot of those films now, is because those kids that had those images and had those films and had those kind of emotions thrown at them when they were growing up and in their formative years are starting to come into their own as artists and filmmakers and realizing that they have a voice to share these stories.
What I find interesting is that, you know, especially in the North American media, it's all about disaster journalism. Mm. And I think that's part of the reason, in a way, why Inconvenient Truth worked was because it took the disaster journalism and told this whole story of what the future is going to become. And yet, our generation, I feel like, yes, we know that's coming, but we try to be more hopeful about it, I guess. What is the importance for you as someone who made the film to not necessarily go down the big, dark disaster route and maybe do not even more lighthearted, but just a more upbeat, hopeful outcome?
Well, that was something I always wanted to do with the film, is that I was very... I guess you could say I was really disappointed in the narrative that was taking over everything in regards to this conversation, whether it was it was very bleak, and I mean, it's not that it isn't still bleak, but it's hard to look at something that you have to work with and be a part of and fight over a long period of time if you're exhausted and just completely full of despair. It's like, I feel like a lot of these movies like dug a hole and we were put in the hole and then there was no way to get out. And so I wanted to really make a film that was, you know, looking at this from the perspective of my generation, which is like, okay, here's the rest of your life. Here's the next 50, 60 years. What are you going to do about it? But also to tell a story that wasn't just a bunch of old white guys saying how screwed we are, because that doesn't help. That had a time and a place, but it's not helping anymore.
It's ironic that you bring that up about the old white guys, because yes, you know, they're on both sides. Most of the climate deniers are old white guys, and yet most of the climate scientists that are telling us we're in trouble are old white guys.
Yes.
And how much, in terms of us fighting the environment and sort of changing ways of society, how much does diversity play into that, getting out of the old white man trope?
Oh, it's huge. I mean, you see it with the indigenous blogs that are coming up and really, in so many ways, leading movements and leading masses of people to this way of protest and of being an activist that is stemmed out of our shared humanity, which I don't think was there before. You're starting to see the Global South come up and realize that, you know what, maybe we don't have to be in this role of victim anymore, because we deserve to have a seat at the table. And really, it's the old white guys of the world who put us in this position.
Yeah.
And so I think that diversity is one of the most exciting things that's happening. It's one of the most exciting things about the global youth climate movement is how diverse it is, and that it is really looking at climate change through a global perspective and one that is of our shared humanity. It also makes it easier to be a part of this.
I think activists, wherever they fall on the political spectrum, whether it's left or right, often get criticized for approaching whatever there's activists about from an emotional perspective. Mm-hmm. And yet with climate change, there's so much more behind it. As both as an activist, as a filmmaker, how much did you look into this the climate science and the numbers during your journey of making this film?
So I set out with the film acknowledging and that the science has been proved. Climate change is happening. We need to keep warming, preferably under 1.5 degrees Celsius, so that we don't, you know, lose entire swaths of the population and coastal cities and island nations. It'll, you know, people are pushing for more of a 2-degree things. It's important. And having gone to UN climate change conferences where it is so much about the science, and so much about the numbers and numbers on a page, it felt very dehumanizing. And I think that's, the science is one of the great strengths of this issue, and it's also, I think, one of the things that really is off-putting to a lot of people, because, you know, you throw out a number, 1.5, and it seems incredibly small. But then when you look at that, and you look at the warming, of, you know, since pre-industrial levels, and really this very finite kind of little part out of the history of the entire planet that we've been able to carve out our civilization and live and be a part of and create humanity as we know it, it's very fragile. And when you start realizing that, you start gravitating, or at least I felt like I started gravitating towards the more emotional aspect, because the planet's going to be fine. The planet is going to change and adapt and become new. It's humans, really, that I think we should be worried about. You know, that's what this issue has become, is like, oh, human survival. In order for us to, you know, we can't stop climate change now, but in order for us to adapt, we have to change everything. And that's both incredibly exciting and like, oh, hey, maybe we can use this as a way to like, you know, finally become the caring, just and sustainable and like not totally terrible people that maybe we've always dreamed of becoming. But it's also really scary to look outside of the bubble of your own life.
Do you think, like, you know, the to go back to the old white man trope, the people who are climate deniers, or even those who aren't deniers but are sort of maybe apathetic towards the whole issue, is a lot of it because they just don't understand the science? And if so, what can we do to, yes, it's been proven, but I think people have to understand it in order to get on the side. So
do you have to understand how a car works or how a plane flies? Because we seemingly trust scientists with almost every aspect of our life, except when it comes to this one thing that's asking us to change how we live. And then we get up in arms about it.
So then, is the bigger question, is it because this type of change makes us uncomfortable?
Oh, yeah. One thing that has become more clear to me as I've been going to film festivals and been in Q&As and working out how I talk about this is that I think that a lot of the problems that have gotten us in the position that we're in now can't be fixed in the same like society that we live in, because we need to change how we eat, we need to change how we consume energy. That's asking us to live in different ways. Like, it doesn't work anymore, and the solutions to this problem lie in a different direction. And it's hard. I mean, if you've like gone along your life and it's like, okay, you've gone to high school, you go to college, you get married, you have kids, you've done all the things that you're supposed to do that mean that you've like succeeded in your life. And then if you get to a point where someone's like, oh, actually, we need to do things a different way now. I always think of my family in Alberta, who I haven't actually spoken to really in like 10 years because they work for the fossil fuel industry. And whenever I've tried to have a conversation with them, I think they take it personally because they look at it as a challenge to the way that they were able to take care of their families. Sorry for rambling.
It's okay. Well, I want to touch on something because you mentioned changing what we eat. And there's been a lot of studies recently that some things will say one thing, but debate the impact that eating meat has on our environment. And some say, you know, you need to go vegetarian and vegan.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the counter argument of that, it was like, but that's a Western luxury. And so, sure, we can afford to do that, but people in third world countries don't have that option.
Yeah.
Where are you on meat and food and how it ties in to the whole climate conversation?
Well, I think what's usually sometimes not brought up when that's put out there is that we need to stop eating meat, is that you need to look at it as the industrial agriculture that is so prevalent in the West has just overtaken the fossil fuel industry in terms of emissions, in terms of general destruction of natural resources. There's eating meat where it's like it's from down the road, you get it from a local farmer, it's all within your like local way of eating and being, and like you know where the meat came from. And then there's a difference between that and like the Amazon rainforest being bulldozed in order to like have an incredibly large number of cows for that industrial agricultural system. So I struggle with it because, I mean, yes, part of me wants to be like, yes, okay, just all meat, just stop. You know, everyone become vegetarian, but you're right, not everyone can do that. But it's funny because then, so part of the film I shot in Nepal, which is one of their biggest issues, is food security. You don't go to a grocery store, you don't go out and get your food, you grow what you eat. And so they're a country that has contributed like 0.5% to the global emissions. And you know, they're the fourth most vulnerable country to the effects of climate change. So you can't just go to a country like that and be like, okay, well, y'all need to stop eating meat, when that's one of like their only source of protein. So a lot of these conversations that are happening are so like they're so based and centric to the West, and in how like we've become so like such just the way that we live is just out of control. Like, we overconsume everything. That's the problem.
Yeah. And it's funny, on the vegetables part, like, you know, I come from the West Coast, so I'm surrounded by, you know, hipsters who like their avocados and their almond milk. And of course, almond farms are one of the biggest...
And avocado
farms. Yeah, like those two are like the two biggest contributors to the agri monoculture, as I think, yeah, as we like to call it. And so... How do we change the narrative in regards to food, do you think?
Oh, man. I mean, I feel lucky enough to live on a farm where I can grow the majority of the vegetables that I eat. I've been getting more and more into permaculture and looking into regenerative agriculture, and I'm trying to figure out a way to talk to the farmers around me who are part of the monoculture system in terms of growing and having cattle and whatnot. And reframing the situation, or reframing the story, really. I don't know, it's hard. It's hard. I mean, there's not one solution to everything. And that's why it's hard, and that's why we're still having the same conversations that we have had for decades, is because there isn't one blanket, you know, solution. Everyone has to do a bunch of little things and a bunch of big things and make their governments get off their ass and do something. So when it comes to food, it's hard, because, like, you know, you can, let's say you eat all organic, but everything has been shipped. Should I have made a way?
I'll tell you.
Let's say you eat an entirely organic diet, but everything that you eat has been shipped in from all over the world. So then you look at the carbon footprint of your organic diet, and in some ways that is worse than you eating local and it being sprayed. It's very strange, because then you have to, like, come to this balance of, like, well, what does this actually mean? And then you look more and more into what you eat. Again, it's just the whole thing, the whole desire, I think, of wanting to be able to just go to the grocery store and, like, okay, I've done everything, it's all organic, it's fine. Yeah. But whether it's what you eat, whether it's where your energy comes from, where your clothing comes from, we have to really step up and be aware of what we're doing.
You mentioned how it's, you know, the conversation is very Western centric, and yeah, I know you're a dual citizen of both Canada and the U.S.,
double the guilt.
What do you make of the respective governments' policies and action towards climate change?
So that is a hard question to answer. I will try to not get really angry. I mean, when you look at the States, it has just become so out of the norm, I think, of what is, even when you look at politics and policies that are bad, it's just, I don't even know how to describe it or talk about it anymore. I was in Paris in 2015 for the UN Climate Change Conference, where the Paris Climate Deal came out. And the thing about it is that it's not legally binding, which sucks, because I don't know. I mean, it's there's a lot of, like, okay, we're all going to work together and it's going to be great. And then to not even have one of the world's most polluting countries and economies to not even, like, be a part of a morally binding deal is really disconcerting. So, I mean, I look at the States, and again, it's just that not wanting to give up a life of convenience. It's easier. It's easier to live, to be able to go to the grocery store, you can get this, you can get that, and to just keep your head down and keep moving forward because it's easier. In Canada, I mean, it feels much the same way. And, like, you look at Trudeau, and he basically became the, you know, world's newest oil exec. Yeah. And, like, that feels terrible. You look at the North American kind of sphere where we're at, and it just seems like there's a huge wake-up call coming where I don't know if we're ready for it as a country. I don't know if we're ready to deal with that, because so much of the way that we live is based on fossil fuels. And, you know, either people are having that conversation and are getting beaten by cops and are getting arrested or are not being listened to, or it's just not happening.
What about the impact and involvement of the indigenous community? Because, mm-hmm, like the pipeline, for example, was, yep, going to go through like 23 different territories, but not all of them were in agreement. Like, some were outright opposed, some were sort of had somewhat support. So, mm-hmm, in terms of going forward, whether it's enacting policies or just the greater conversation around climate change and the environment, how do we need to involve the people who were here before us?
I think we need to acknowledge we need to acknowledge that they were here before us. We need to listen, do so much listening. I mean, from my own just being lucky enough to hang out with and be friends with people who are within Indigenous blocs and Indigenous movements, I mean, there is such a deep inherent knowing and understanding and connectedness that is very difficult to see in a lot of other facets of the movement. And I think because we have, we've really fucked it up, we have to start listening and we have to acknowledge that they have the potential and are stepping up to the potential of being the true leaders of this movement, because, I mean, it feels right. I mean, I feel like I can't really talk about it because I'm not Indigenous, I'm not part of that community, but I have the utmost respect and just sheer admiration for what they've been able to accomplish and do.
I think one movement that we've seen is, especially when it comes to the food industry, is the movement to ban plastic, mm-hmm. whether it's lids or straws. And of course, Starbucks got flayed for then having more plastic.
Yeah.
And a lot of people feel that the straws, it's a small solution to a big issue, but it also takes away from, you know, those, you know, disabled people or those in wheelchairs who may need straws to help them drink. Where are you on the straw and plastic debate in terms of how much of an impact they have?
Well, I think it's the tip of the iceberg in terms of our use of plastic and consuming and throwing away. Like in terms of clothing, it's absolutely disgusting how much we actually don't keep. We buy so much and then we throw so much of it away. When it comes to straws, I don't know if this will, you know, garner me ill will, but I feel like that's a distraction to say that, oh, we can't get rid of straws because of those who are disabled and need them. Then let's make metal straws. Like, let's replace it with something that is the same thing and will do the same thing but is lasting and will not probably end up in a landfill or in the ocean and, you know, contribute to that enormous mess. In terms of plastic, I mean, it's horrifying. I remember when I first heard about the Great, you know, Pacific Patch. It just was, it's almost incomprehensible. But I think it's because it's just part, again, going back to, we have developed and we have built a society and a way of living in a way that views the earth as there being no glass ceiling. There is no glass ceiling. There's always room for growth. And a lot of us have come to the conclusion and actually see, and most people I think see, that that is a complete fallacy. It doesn't exist. I don't know, when it comes to plastic, I think there are so many ways that we can live without it. It's just getting the industries and getting, you know, so much of our economy that relies on cheap materials in order to make things. So again, it's being conscious. It's not going out and buying a $2 shirt and having $52 shirts from H&M or whatever. It's like, go out and buy a shirt that was like, maybe it's a little bit more expensive, but you're not, you know, there's not someone. It's just, I think we've become addicted to instantaneous gratification and the ability to have a whole bunch of stuff, and that's not good.
Yeah. Are you hopeful for the future, you know, given that our generation is very active and aware, and slowly but surely the older money will die off, and, you know, the younger people will rise up. Is there hope, do you think, in that regard?
I think there always has to be hope. But even though I say that, like, I live on a farm because I don't know what's going to happen, and because I feel like I want to have a backup plan, and I want to be able to know how to grow my own food and take care of myself in a natural setting. But I think there always has to be hope, because then why don't we just go and throw ourselves off a building right now? It is so, it's that almost naive, idealistic hope that I keep coming back to again and again of, I would rather live my day-to-day feeling like I did everything that I could and I am doing everything I could so that I can even just very simply be able to live with myself But I think a lot of people are waking up and are seeing the possibilities for how we can change the way that we live, and how cool that is, how amazing that is. And that makes me inspired. And also, I can't give up hope, because there's an entire generation behind me and behind them that if I just give up hope, what is that going to say to them? And then they're going to do nothing. It's you can't. We have a moral obligation and responsibility to not lose hope, because if we lose hope, then no one else is going to be taking up this issue and fighting for it, because they won't be around.
What do you want the audience who sees Youth Unstoppable to take away, whether they're young people or old people or somewhere in between? The sound of the blow dryer.
Other than the power of Dyson air blades, I want the audience to come away from this film with the feeling deep down in their bones that they want to be a part of this change, and that they can see it, and they see the young people who are showing up again and again and being thrown out and not being allowed to have a voice or whatever, and just seeing that and recognizing that they themselves can also be an agent of change, and that it's not me trying to force people to feel like they have to change. I hope that they feel and see and experience the same things that I do, and they want to change, because we all want a better world. We want cleaner air, we want cleaner water, we want better jobs. We want to have a degree of joy and happiness in our lives. We can have that. It's all right there. It's all right there waiting for us to go out there and make the changes necessary. And it's going to be hard, and it's going to take a lot, but it's going to be worth it. And I also want them to see that they're not alone in this, that it is hard and it is scary and it is overwhelming, but that we're all in it together. As corny as that sounds, we are.
Well, the film is Youth Unstoppable, and it's playing at the Planet in Focus Film Festival. Slater Jewel Kempker, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
That was my conversation with filmmaker and activist Slater Jewel Kempker. Her film is Youth Unstoppable, and it plays in Toronto on October 25th as part of the Planet in Focus Film Festival. We have another youth-related interview. I speak with up-and-coming young actor Luca Velasquez. He's in a great, brilliant, taut Canadian thriller titled Knuckleball, and it follows his character who is supposed to spend a weekend with his grandfather in the Canadian wilderness while his parents attend a family funeral. Of course, doesn't go as planned, and he soon finds himself trapped with his grandfather's mysterious neighbor. Who has his own ideas of what is fun for a 13-year-old boy. It is a very, very brilliantly written and acted film. Luca is the star of the film, and he stars opposite some other big names in Canada. Monroe Chambers, who you may remember from his days on Degrassi, where he starred as Eli, and also Canadian film legend Michael Ironside, who stars as Grandpa. I spoke with Luca earlier in the week to talk about the film. Here is my conversation with Luca Velasquez. Luca Velasquez, hello, welcome. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
So you're in this bold new Canadian thriller, Knuckleball. In terms of getting the role of Henry, was this your normal, typical audition process that you went through?
Not necessarily. I mean, like, some of the aspects were normal, but to start off the audition, actually, the director, Michael Peterson, he actually called me on the phone because he's seen some of my previous work and he said he was interested. So we had a phone call, and I went that all went really well. And then he just asked me to do some scenes. Like, so that's like how a normal audition would be. You do a scene.
Right.
So I did some scenes on tape and I sent it off. And from there, I got the role. Just no, I didn't even come in a second time. I just got the role. So it was kind of different in a way because it started with a phone call, and also like there wasn't really any callback or any right. other stages after that.
What was that like for you as an actor, and as you know, as to use the term up and coming, to know that you already have a director that's interested in your work and interested in working with you?
You know what? It's just it's amazing to see that people are accepting the work that I'm doing, and also like at such an early age and such an early stage of my acting career, I personally am like super happy that they see potential in me, because from this moment on, I just keep on planning to grow and grow and grow and get better and better. So the fact that people are already accepting and, you know, giving positive feedback on what I'm doing, it's just, it's really exciting. And I really want to see how good I can really get.
And you also got to work with probably one of the most legendary Canadian film actors in the last 40 years or so. Michael Ironside, who plays your,
yes.
your grandpa Jacob in the film. What was it like acting opposite somebody like him? Because I know he's very method.
Honestly, you know what? It was terrific. He's honestly one of the like best guys I've ever met with. He's so wise, and he has so many. His backstory is super interesting, and just working with him, it honestly felt like I was really his grandson, because like he dives so deep into his roles and he acts like a grandparent to you. I mean, like every time you get to set, we would hug, like he'd do everything a grandfather would do. And just acting with him was just an enlightening experience. And after between takes, he would always give me tips on how to improve myself. And he knows acting on such a unique way that I've never heard anyone talk about it before. And just having the privilege to work with him really, I think, just from that moment, helped me grow so much. And it was just amazing.
Is he someone that, you know, maybe both as a person and as an actor, you would turn to advice for? Or do you kind of leave that off to the side when you're working together with somebody?
No, actually, I think I would actually turn to him sometimes for advice, because actually he would sometimes be on the actual set with us, and I would sometimes turn to advice for him. I'll say, so let's say we were doing a shot, and I'm like, okay, so how's this way of doing it? And I'd be like, okay, yeah, but you should do it this way. And then I'd always ask him, like, you know, why do I need to do it that way? And he would always explain to me. So it wasn't really, I just leave it off to the side. Actually, when I was kind of stuck, I would actually turn to him for advice.
Now the film is called Knuckleball because you Henry and Jacob share a passion for baseball. I'm curious, what is your relationship with baseball like?
I don't really watch baseball that much. I'm quite distant from it. My favorite sport is soccer, but I was certainly open to, you know, I tried all sports in my life, and baseball I have tried. I haven't really stuck with it. So my relationship is quite distant with baseball. I kind of had to get used to it prior to filming. So like I was learning some of the grips to do. Because Henry's he loves baseball. So I had to kind of get into a baseball lover's mindset.
How much did you have to work on your pitching? Because there's a scene very early on where Grandpa is teaching Henry how to throw a ball. How in terms of learning all the different mechanics, what was that process like?
In order for me to learn, I looked up some YouTube videos. I looked up like some of the sciences behind like how a knuckleball moves in the air, how to throw one. And I basically just did that process for each of the grips that I learned, like the change-ups, the finger, and, of course, the knuckleball.
This film takes a dark turn about half an hour or so into the film. As an actor, when you're in that type of environment and in those types of scenes, how do you make sure that you don't get too far down into that hole, if you will?
Well, I think in this case, it wasn't really a worry for me, because all the casting crew was just absolutely great. I mean, of course, like when they were doing the take, you kind of have to get into that mindset. But it was so easy to transition from that, you know, terrified, petrified mindset to just a normal kid mindset again, because everyone was just so welcoming and they were so supportive, and it made the transition a lot easier. So it wasn't really a worry for me.
What was it like working opposite Monroe in such close quarters?
Monroe is just—he's such a nice guy. He's a great guy. He's worked with Michael Ironside a lot, so he kind of brought some knowledge. He brought some knowledge as well to the set. And since I was working with him mostly, he was just such a supportive person, and he would always, you know, tell me little tips and tricks on how to make stunts even bigger. And he would always ask me if I'm okay after we did a scene. And it was just—he was a great person to work alongside.
You're almost in every scene of this movie. Save a couple bits here and there. What's it like to know that you are carrying this thing on your shoulders in a way?
In a way, of course, there's always pressure. I mean, you want to do the best you can, but for me, I just like to think of it. I'm blessed that I had that opportunity at such an early age. So I really just embraced it. And I just thought positive all the time, and it really took the pressure off, and it just made me act the way this character is supposed to be, and it made me really focus on the acting part rather than focusing on, oh my God, like this is an hour and a half movie that I have to carry, that I'm the lead of. So I think just kind of thinking positive and just saying like, oh, this is gonna work out, it's gonna turn out great, really helped me.
The film obviously takes place in a very isolated location in a forest, in a very harsh winter. Shooting in that type of environment, how much did the elements come into play, and how do you think that affects an actor, if at all?
It wasn't really too bad until we got to a whole week of night shoots. There was a whole week where we just shot outside in the night, and that's when it got really cold. It was like minus 30, sometimes even borderline minus 40. And there's a couple scenes that I think, if you've seen the movie, where I'm on the roof, and it's and like my shirt's open, and it's teared open, and like I have to fall on a whole bunch of snow, and plus there's wind machines that they were blowing wind machines on either side of me, so like there was just even more wind hitting me in the face. And you know, at sometimes it was cold. Like I was actually cold. But I think part of the some of the adrenaline that I had shooting all those scenes really it made me feel the effects less. But I know for the crew, actually, the cameras kept on freezing. So for one of the sequences that they did, they had to stay up till 7 in the morning to shoot that sequence, because the cameras kept on freezing. So I know it was a big effect for the crew, but for the actors necessarily, for me at least personally, it didn't really affect me.
Weather aside, how difficult are night shoots compared to day shoots, would you say? Because you're obviously, you know, you might be in a different mind frame, or you're in a different sort of, you know, sleep pattern. How would you contrast shooting it, you know, in the afternoon versus shooting overnight?
I think the biggest obstacle is just fighting the fatigue. I mean, you know, this sleepiness of like being out like till 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock at night, because, you know, regularly you go to bed maybe 10 o'clock and you're by the time you're going to bed, you're already relaxed. You've already, you know, had your dinner. You've already sat on the couch, watched the TV. But, you know, working till 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, I guess you have to kind of fight the fatigue of it. And I guess the main contrast is just really fighting the fatigue of it. Shooting the night.
This film was shot very intimately in a lot of ways, in that it's, you know, you and Michael close together, or you and Monroe close together, or you and your parents. Was there a favorite scene or two, or a favorite moment that you just really enjoyed that came up during filming?
There was a couple favorite moments, but one of them was really, there's a dinner sequence where my character asks Michael's character, like, why did that guy do that today? like, why did he come up to me and do that? What happened? Why'd you hit him, right? And that one was, it was super interesting. It was a super interesting scene because in a lot of ways, like, it felt really at home. I felt like you were having dinner. I think once we stopped shooting that scene, I just had like a real, like, wow, what just happened there? That felt so real. And that was one of the moments where I really felt really close to Michael.
When something like that happens, like, do you, you know, where you have such a visceral reaction to a scene, do you find that it takes you out of the movie, takes you out of the art and into somewhere else?
I think when you have that kind of visceral reaction, as you said, I think it doesn't necessarily take you out of the art. I think it just brings you, I think it just, you kind of grab the art more, you kind of hone in on it, on the craft more, and you just dive deeper to its source, which is, and it ends up being so natural. I wouldn't necessarily say that you're kind of distancing yourself, you're just grabbing onto it more, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, for sure. We kind of joked that we said earlier that this film takes place, you know, in a very harsh, snowy winter in the middle of the wilderness, and somehow that seems very, very Canadian. Why do you think film? We see a lot of films like this that come from Canada, and a lot of really good films like this that come from our country that are sort of that use this setting as a way forward in their films.
Yeah. Well, I think that you know, each country has a symbol that they're really known for, and for us, I think it's our heavy, our dense forestry and our really extreme weather in some areas. And I think when people want to get, like, a real sense of isolation in their movies, or they want to get, like, you know, a beautiful landscape shot, Canada's the place to come, because everything here is just extreme. Like, the weather here in I know in Alberta, it's super cold up there, and I think when you want to get that sense of dread, that feeling of, like, coldness and isolation, they come to particularly these cold areas because the weather is super, it hits super hard, and there's so much of it to work with.
What I think really surprised me about the film was that I think because of its setting and the limited characters and the thriller, it there was a danger of it maybe sort of dragging out and becoming monotonous, but I felt that it really, really, really moved quite quickly. I'm curious, as someone who was in the film, why do you think that the film works?
I think the film works because of everyone's chemistry, and also terrific writing. The writing was really terrific. It dealt with topics that the writing really executed, I think, very well. And but I think also it's also the chemistry between the whole cast and crew, because without chemistry, a movie can just fall apart. Without chemistry, you can tell that you know there's something going on between two of the co-stars, or you know, some of the crew, or anyone. And I think with the chemistry, that also it also made the movie really glue together as well, because you know without chemistry, it'll just fall apart. Yeah. So you really need chemistry as a kind of like a base, if you will.
Well, the film is Knuckleball, and it's playing now in Toronto at the Carlton Cinema and in Ottawa at the Mayfair Cinema, both one-week engagements. And there are more cities to follow. Luca Velasquez, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, have a good day. Cheers.
You too.
That was my conversation with actor Luca Velasquez. He is the star of the new film Knuckleball, which is playing in select cities across Canada right at this very moment. That does it for the show today. Stay tuned next week when I feature skateboarder and filmmaker Charlie Samuels. It's going to be a very, very, very fun talk. I will see you then. Thanks for tuning in. Goodbye for now.